Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center presents Doc Talk, an informative health series educating our community on the services provided at Peace Health. We will begin with our host, George Henry, after these messages.
Don't miss a beat. Peace Health can help you keep up on the latest for your heart with expert advice, advanced procedures, and comprehensive care. We have more than 50 expert cardiologists and 9 heart clinic locations throughout the Northwest to serve you. Let us put together a personalized heart care plan for you so you can enjoy all of life's incredible moments. Because focusing on your heart means you'll never miss a beat. Learn more at peacehealth.org/hearthealth.
I am a 2-time breast cancer survivor and a big believer in mammograms. I do think they are very important. As a cancer survivor, the journey can be very difficult. But with the right people by your side, anything is possible.
At Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center, you have access to advanced technology and mammogram screenings with enhancements to ensure your comfort. Request your appointment today at peacehealth.org/yes-mamma, because beating cancer is our mission.
Joining me for this edition of Doc Talk is Dr. Elaine Scalabrin. She's a neurohospitalist and medical director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at Riverbend. And a good day to you, Dr. Scalabrin.
Good day to you.
So tell me a little bit about what a neurohospitalist is, just to kind of get a little background.
Okay, so I am a medical doctor, went to medical school, and then did a residency in neurology. Sometimes people confuse the field of neurology with neurosurgery, and I am not a neurosurgeon. Neurosurgeons operate. Neurologists, we're kind of a cognitive specialist. We think a lot. I fell in love with neurosciences when I was in medical school, and I was in a class of 500, and I was the only one who loved it. So I knew it was the right thing for me.
Well, I guess that kind of answers the first question. The other question I had was what drew you to it, and I guess it was just sort of an idea that that's kind of where you wanted to be. You like that aspect of it.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of I've subspecialized in additional fellowships after I did neurology, including stroke. So I did a vascular fellowship in stroke, and then I did what's called a neurocritical care fellowship as well. And that's sort of taking care of intensely ill patients who have suffered a stroke or some other kind of brain injury. And I have always been interested in taking care of the elderly. And so I was very drawn towards this field. I'm also drawn towards acute care medicine as opposed to outpatient medicine. So I am based in a hospital as opposed to a clinic. And that's where the term neuro hospital comes from.
Now, where did you start your educational process for medical school?
So I went to medical school at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then I did my internship in San Francisco and my residency in Virginia, University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And then I did my residency at Stanford and did a second residency at UCSF.
And what's
fellowship,
your
brother?
Okay, and where do you originate from? What's your kind of your history there?
So I'm originally from the Northwest. So I'm from Washington. Actually, went to Washington State for undergrad, and I have moved all over the country, and some parts of Europe. And ultimately, I had the opportunity to get back to the Northwest, and I couldn't wait. So I came back to Oregon, which feels like home away from home.
I wondered if that was the case. Maybe you started off here and said, well, you know, this is because a lot of people end up here for different reasons. But a lot of the folks that do end up here is because they have a tie to it in one way or another. So,
yes, I still have family. But, you know, I think the Northwest is really just, you know, it's just part of me. I feel so much of home amongst the green trees and the wet weather.
Are you an outdoorsy type person as well?
Yes. Yeah. Big hiker mostly.
Okay. That sounds cool. Let's talk a little bit about the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Riverbend. How did it get that certification? How did it achieve that?
So there are various certifying bodies, and there is a gradation of levels of certification that you can apply for. And there are what's called stroke receiving centers. That's a sort of a designation that says that you can take care of a stroke patient. And then there's a what we call a primary stroke center, which means that you can take care of the basic care of stroke, particularly in the acute setting. And then there are centers that do thrombectomy. They're called endovascular ready centers. And then sort of at the top tier is what's termed the comprehensive stroke center. And basically what that means is that you're saying that your center can really take care of any kind of stroke problem, no matter how minor or how severe, and that you can ensure that when patients come to your center, they're going to get the same quality of care no matter what time of the day, no matter what day of the week, they get the same quality of care. And we do more advanced types of treatments for more complex kinds of stroke care. Achieving this certification is a very arduous journey. And there is an enormous number of requirements that you have to meet in order to meet that certification. And it really takes a big team of people working collaboratively across many different departments within the hospital and also within the community and with primary care doctors and rehabilitation doctors and therapists. So it's really it's very big endeavor to pursue comprehensive stroke status.
As the medical director, were you part of the process that got that status, or did you come after the fact?
So yes, I was the medical director that brought us forward towards comprehensive status. When I first moved here to Eugene, it's about 12 years ago, the center was a primary stroke center. And so we had to grow and basically recruit many different types of physicians and get many programs in place until we could move it up into a comprehensive stroke center.
What sort of specialties do the doctors kind of bring to the comprehensive stroke center? I imagine there's different skill sets among even those doctors. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So, like I mentioned, it's cooperative between multiple different departments. So, for instance, our neurosurgical department, we have surgeons that specialize in treating stroke, particularly hemorrhagic stroke that's bleeding into the brain. We have neurologists and intensivists that have taken special fellowships to become certified in taking care of neurological and neurosurgical intensive care patients. We have a special kind of interventionalist called a neurointerventionalist. They train for many, many, many years, and they intervene with stroke in a catheterization, like you've heard of a cardiac catheterization. Well, we do the same type of thing for the brain, using catheters through the artery and feeding them up to the brain and doing procedures in the brain via the arteries. Those specialists, they have a lot of training, and they do really very intricate types of operations.
All right. That sounds like a full staff of a bunch of folks that make this really work for you. That's really cool. I'm speaking with Dr. Elaine Scalabrine. She is the neurohospitalist at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at Riverbend. She's also the medical director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center, and happy to have you here on Doc Talk. We'll be back in just a moment.
Don't miss a beat. Peace Health can help you keep up on the latest for your heart with expert advice, advanced procedures, and comprehensive care. We have more than 50 expert cardiologists and 9 heart clinic locations throughout the Northwest to serve you. Let us put together a personalized heart care plan for you so you can enjoy all of life's incredible moments, because focusing on your heart means you'll never miss a beat. Learn more at peacehealth.org/hearthealth.
I am a two-time breast cancer survivor and a big believer in mammograms. I do think they are very important. As a cancer survivor, the journey can be very difficult. But with the right people by your side, anything is possible.
At Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center, you have access to advanced technology and mammogram screenings with enhancements to ensure your comfort. Request your appointment today at peacehealth.org/yes-mama because beating cancer is our mission.
I'm speaking with Dr. Elaine Scalabrine. She is the neurohospitalist and medical director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at Riverbend. And Dr. Scalabrine, that's a mouthful right there. And I imagine that a lot of responsibility goes with those titles, too.
Yes, that's a lot of responsibility, but I consider it a privilege. Get the unique opportunity to be able to help people when they've had a tragedy strike in their life.
Now, we always know that when there's the symptoms of a stroke, you know, the fastest you can get medical care for that is the best. Have we learned anything new about that timeline there of a patient who's suffering or believes they might be suffering from a stroke?
Well, the field of stroke really changes quite rapidly. There is new research going on all the time, and we are learning things every day. Right now, we generally believe the faster you can get to the hospital, the better your chances of having little or no disability. We know that the brain cells die very, very quickly, and so we need to try to intervene and reverse the effects of the stroke as fast as possible. We've developed more tools in our toolbox to do that. In addition, we've developed more imaging techniques that help us select for some patients that may present late in the window or late in their course. For instance, they will maybe woke up with their stroke and they don't know exactly when it started. We now have some new imaging types of techniques that help us select for patients who may benefit from intervention even in the late windows. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not asking people to sit around and wait at home. We still want to get that at the message that if you have stroke symptoms, you should immediately call 911. Don't call your friends. Don't call your primary care doctor. Don't go to sleep and hope it goes away. We recommend immediately calling 911.
It's interesting because I recently had a colonoscopy, and after that, I think I depleted minerals or something in my body. The next day I started feeling tingling on the entire left side of my body. So I rushed myself over to the hospital not knowing, you know, what was going on. And it turns out that it wasn't anything serious, which I'm happy for. But tell me a little bit about how a stroke or how the symptoms of a stroke appear in the body.
So it's a good question. It's actually very difficult to teach the general public about what the stroke symptoms are because stroke occurs in the brain, and the brain is a very complex computer. And so depending on where the blood clot lands in the brain, in whatever area it affects, it can give different symptoms. You know, it's fairly straightforward. If somebody's having a heart attack, they get chest pain and they can't breathe very well. It's very simple. But for teaching about stroke can be very difficult because the symptoms can vary. They can be very minor or subtle, or they could be very dramatic. In general, when you're having a stroke, it affects one side of the body more than the other. And so you tend to get weakness or numbness on just one side of the body. But it also can affect your vision, your speech, your balance. All of those things can be affected or individually or all together. The key to recognizing a stroke is that it's sudden onset. One minute you're fine, and the next minute you have these symptoms, again, usually on one side of the body.
So define for me just quickly what a stroke actually is. Is it a blood clot? Is it define that for me.
So there are two main types of stroke. One is called the ischemic stroke, which it means that a blood clot has blocked off one of the blood vessels in the brain. And because that blood clot is blocking off the circulation, there's not enough oxygen or nutrients that go to the brain, and the brain starts to die. Now, there's a less common stroke called a hemorrhagic stroke. That's when the when a blood vessel bursts and there's bleeding into the brain. Now, they can be bleeding into or around the brain, and we consider that a stroke. That tends to be much more serious stroke. People tend to have much more disability from bleeding kind of stroke, but thankfully, it's much less common.
Let me see how I want to phrase this. I'm imagining, based on how you defined that, that a stroke, unlike a heart attack, if your physical reaction is like stressed out and immediately like going crazy, worrying about this, it's not going to really change the effects of the stroke much, as opposed to being calm and remaining kind of, you know, just not overly excited. Does that make a difference in the severity?
No, likely not in the severity. Mm-hmm. You know, we do know that stress causes can contribute to lots of medical problems over time, and those medical problems can contribute to a stroke. But becoming excited in and amongst itself isn't going to make you have a bad stroke. And certainly being stressed out isn't going to make you necessarily worse. And I always say if stress itself caused a stroke, I probably would have had a million by now.
Yeah. So I've often heard this, and I don't know if it's true, so let's dispel the rumor or confirm it one way or the other, that people that have a stroke are more predisposed to have another one. Is that accurate? Or is it just all dependent?
Yes, that's accurate. Anytime you've had a stroke, you're at increased chance of having another. We do have very well recognized risk factors for stroke. And the vast majority of people who have stroke have some risk factors that they may or may not know that they have. And so we know that we can lower the risk of recurrent stroke by lowering or modifying those risk factors.
So some of
by
those,
far, sorry.
I was going to say, so some of those risk factors are?
By far and away, the most common, most potent risk factor for both kinds of stroke, the blood clot stroke and the bleeding kind of stroke, is high blood pressure. People have in general, sometimes there's not a very good understanding about what it means to have high blood pressure. High blood pressure is a condition called hypertension. And hypertension is diagnosed if you have consistently a blood pressure over 140, over 90. And it's a condition in which you have for a life long. It's not a number. It's an actual disorder. And what you want in terms of the best optimal health is to have your blood pressures be less than 120 over 80. And so if you have the condition of hypertension, that means that you have to spend an extra time understanding and knowing your condition and shooting for a goal blood pressure of less than 120 over 80 in order to limit your risk of stroke.
So I can understand how the hypertension, the high blood pressure would affect like a hemorrhagic stroke, but what does it do to help cause a blood clot in an ischemic stroke?
So hypertension is what we call the silent killer because it doesn't have any symptoms really at all until it's too late. And what happens is that the blood vessels see this high blood pressure over time and they start to thicken because the pressure is just so much that they start to thicken, and then areas inside the blood vessels start to break down. So it leads to things like atherosclerosis or clogging of the arteries. It can lead to heart disease, and heart disease itself can cause blood clots, and the blood clots can go to the brain. It can lead to other what we call small vessel diseases. The very small vessels of the brain start to close down over time. And typically what happens in that condition is people gradually develop dementia from this small vessels closing down over time.
So is a clot itself, is that like plaque that breaks loose, or is it blood itself? How is that defined?
So that's a good question. A clot is blood. Basically, it's a combination of blood proteins and platelets that sort of clump all together. And, you know, that's a good thing that we have developed blood clots. We have a mechanism in which we get cut. We don't bleed to death because we get blood clots. The problem is that when the blood vessels are damaged or injured or have plaque into them, they become irregular and they may even rupture. And so when you have a rupture of a plaque inside the artery, the body thinks it's an injury. So it sends a blood clot to try to fix the rupture. And then that blood clot incidentally causes a stroke. So it's kind of the last event that happens in a cascade of things that leads to a stroke.
Well, that's interesting to know, because I'd never thought of it that way. You know, like you said, you always think of the injuries outside the body. You don't necessarily think of what the body's doing internally to cause that. That's pretty cool. How common are strokes in the U.S.? Like one in every how many people?
You always ask me this kinds of one in questions. I never know the answers to those. Oh. There's about 800,000 strokes per year, and about 180,000 of those are recurrent.
And is that U.S. calculations or is that worldwide?
Yes, okay. That's United States. It's the fifth leading cause of death, and it's the first leading cause of adult disability.
Do we know if the U.S. has a higher rate than other countries?
The countries widely vary. In particular, the continent of Asia, they have a much higher risk of hemorrhagic stroke than we do. And so it very much depends on genetics and regions in terms of stroke. We have certainly, I think worldwide, we have on about the average.
Do you have any data on who has the lowest? I'm just curious. If you don't, that's fine. But
Not right off the top of my head. I don't.
I was just curious because I kind of like to try and correlate and see, well, if I could figure out why, maybe maybe I could reproduce what they're doing over there. You already mentioned some of the risks for stroke, but what about lifestyle risks that are out there?
So the lifestyle risks, it turns out, are the same risks that you've heard about for heart disease. And so we know that when people are inactive, that can lead to premature stroke. Weight, when people are overweight or obese, that can lead to premature stroke. In terms of diet, we recommend a low-salt diet. We know that people that have a high salt intake have higher blood pressures. And then, of course, avoiding refined sugars and saturated fats, maintaining a healthy diet, healthy sleep in particular. Obstructive sleep apnea, or the disorder that causes people to stop breathing when they're sleeping, it's an independent risk factor for stroke. So a lot of people don't think of sleep apnea. How could that cause a stroke? But what it does is that the body has low oxygen during the time of sleeping, and that leads to damages of the blood vessels.
Now, you mentioned the salt factor, and I want to ask you a little bit more about that, because my sense is that the body needs a certain amount of salt. I guess what you're suggesting is be label conscious, not use over amounts, because we do. Do we not need some salt in our system?
It's very difficult in an American diet to get a low salt diet. You really have to try hard. So in other words, we have plenty of salt naturally in the food that we eat. So you really want to read labels, stay away from high sodium things, particularly prepared foods. Processed foods tend to be high in salt. And, you know, getting used to not adding extra salt because we have so much salt already in our food.
I'm just curious if you know, marketing would tell us that there's some salts are better than other salts. Is all salt salt? I mean, when it comes down to it, pink Himalayan versus, you know, iodized.
Yeah, I don't know of any data looking at sodium chloride, which is what we would call regular salt. There's certainly data looking at potassium chloride. We know potassium is helpful. It tends not to be very well tolerated in general. It's not a very tasty salt. So I think the simple message really is just start really simple. Don't add salt. Just don't have a salt shaker. Don't add salt. And at first it's a little hard, but then you start to get used to it. And if you added salt later, you think, wow, this is so salty, I can barely stand it. Your taste buds, you know, get accustomed to a lower level of salt, and you can cut back gradually without really missing out.
I tend to agree. I think it's all about what we accustom ourselves to, and the idea of we taste the salt in foods when we don't use additional salt in there eventually.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm speaking with Dr. Elaine Scalabrin. She is a neurohospitalist and the medical director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. And we'll be back with more on this edition of Doc Talk.
Don't miss a beat. Peace Health can help you keep up on the latest for your heart with expert advice, advanced procedures, and comprehensive care. We have more than 50 expert cardiologists and 9 heart clinic locations throughout the Northwest to serve you. Let us put together a personalized heart care plan for you so you can enjoy all of life's incredible moments. Because focusing on your heart means you'll never miss a beat. Learn more at peacehealth.org/hearthealth.
I am a 2-time breast cancer survivor and a big believer in mammograms. I do think they are very important. As a cancer survivor, the journey can be very difficult. But with the right people by your side, anything is possible.
At Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center, you have access to advanced technology and mammogram screenings with enhancements to ensure your comfort. Request your appointment today at peacehealth.org/yes-mamma because beating cancer is our mission.
I'm speaking with Dr. Elaine Scalabrin. She's neurohospitalist and medical director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. And we were talking a little bit about risk factors and lowering your, well, we hadn't really gotten to the lowering your risk, but you did mention a couple things like movement, exercise, and stuff like that. Tell me a little bit more about the risk factors.
Well, we know that smoking leads to atherosclerosis or clogging of the arteries. So smoking tobacco is very bad. In addition, the use of illicit drugs. It's worth a mention because I think in particularly in Oregon, we've experienced a big spike in the use of methamphetamines. And I'm not sure that people are really aware that methamphetamines themselves are very highly associated with stroke. And that's both the clotting and bleeding type of stroke, but typically it would be the bleeding type. People who take methamphetamines, even if they only took it once, can suffer from a bleeding type of stroke. And not only is it a bad stroke, but these can be young people who are then disabled for years and years and years, and, you know, cut down in their prime of their life. And the statistics show that those people that have methamphetamine or stimulant associated stroke, they tend to not do as well. So when I talk about the stimulant induced, so there's a class of medications, and with methamphetamine is one, amphetamines, cocaine, all of those can cause stroke or associated with stroke.
So go ahead. I'm sorry. Did you have more?
Just in addition, you know, we recommend limiting alcohol. We also recommend limiting cannabis. There's the most recent studies of people who take a high concentration and high doses of cannabis daily have an independent risk factor for ischemic stroke.
And they don't also function well in many other things, too, from time to time. So you kind of answered the next question was strokes occurring mainly in the senior population. But as you said, you know, the onset of methamphetamine use and drug use and that. What about genetic risk factors in younger folks or non-drug related strokes in younger population? Does that occur?
Yes, people often think of stroke as an old person's disease, and it's true that it does occur at a higher rate in the elderly, and that rate goes up as we age. But the truth is that stroke can happen to anyone at any age, including children. Most of the time when we see very young strokes, there's usually some identifiable risk that can be, say, a heart defect or maybe a clotting problem that they clot more easily. But we've seen an alarming trend over the last 10 years. We've seen a rise in young stroke, and that's really defined as less than 40 years of age. And we believe the signal seems to show us that it's that lifestyle, weight, and inactivity are leading younger people to developing atherosclerosis prematurely, so much earlier than we would expect, because we're living in a society that tends to, you know, be overweight, not take as good a care of ourselves, and not be as physically active. So we've started seeing a shift of stroke occurring at a higher incidence in young people.
We're kind of running short on time, but I want to get a couple other things in there. Number one, if you recognize a person maybe having a stroke or someone tells you they think they're having a stroke, what is the best course of action a person could take to help that individual?
Call 911. If you believe you are witnessing a stroke of anybody, whether it's a stranger or a loved one, call 911. They will be transported to the nearest hospital. We have a very good system here in Oregon in which our hospitals are ready to receive stroke patients, and they contact us at the Comprehensive Stroke Center right away to get advice about getting the patients rapidly treated. On occasion, and when people live out in even rural places, we can provide a helicopter transport if needed, if people are having a very large life-threatening stroke. So the key is to call 911.
Now, you kind of mentioned it there, but you didn't specifically state what hospital. But like, for example, out here on the coast, I would imagine that the first segment of the transportation would be to Peace Harbor, if with all other things not being available.
So, yeah, most of our patients will go straight to Peace Harbor, and Peace Harbor has a great emergency department that is very well trained in recognizing and treating stroke early. They often will treat the patients and then transfer those patients here to River Bend for continuing care or for more aggressive care. We do have a protocol with Western Lane in which they, if they go to a scene in which at the scene, they recognize the person has what's called C-stat positive, which is a scale that indicates that it's a very large artery that's blocked. They have a protocol in which they can fly the patients directly to us, and we can take them rapidly to the cath lab to remove those large clots.
Well, Dr. Scalabrin, thank you so much. We could talk for probably another half an hour and get more great information from you, and maybe you'll come back and talk more about this at some point in the future. But certainly some great information there, and just appreciate your time.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. That is Dr. Elaine Scalabrin. She's a neurohospitalist at medical director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Doc Talk.
You have been listening to Doc Talk, presented by Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. For more information on the program and services provided, visit peacehealth.org.